Welcome to Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel, brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints.
Hello, genies. You have found us. America's Family History Show, Extreme Genes and ExtremeGenes.com. I am Fisher, your radio root sleuth, on the show where we shake your family tree and watch the nuts fall out. Well, I hope you're enjoying some great breakthroughs in your research as you put to use some of the great ideas our experts share on the program. And by the way, I took some of my own advice this past week about collecting things relating to ancestors. I have search terms pre-programmed into eBay, and this past week, one of them generated an email alerting me that a couple of ribbons from the New York Veteran Firemen's Association's 1887 trip to San Francisco were up for auction. One welcomed the former volunteers to Kansas City, and the other was from Omaha as they passed through. My great-grandfather was one of the 104 veterans to make the cross-continental trip, which was written about in papers from coast to coast, and even though these ribbons almost certainly weren't his, he undoubtedly had one of each of these when he returned to New York in early October of that year. Both are in great condition for 128 years old and will display very nicely. You ought to try this because every once in a while something hits the market that's a must-have. All right, coming up today, we're going to be talking to Megan Smolenyak, a self-proclaimed genealogy adventurer. I like that. Megan is a well-known writer and researcher. She's been on the network talk shows and was the discoverer of President Obama's Irish ancestral line. Recently, she was asked to come up with something new on Hillary Clinton's ancestry, and that she did. And with it came a challenge to virtually every so-called recreational genealogist. What did she find, and what does this experience say to us? You will find out in just a few minutes. Then later in the show, from AncestryProGenealogist.com, Gordon Remington talks about those long lines all the way back to Adam and Eve. Do you have one? Do you know someone who does? Well, he's got something important to tell you about that unique lineage. And then Tom Perry, our preservation authority from TMCPlace.com, joins us with more common sense advice about preserving your family history treasures. It is time once again for your Family Histoire news, and we start out with news of a couple of great TV shows. Well, it seems like only yesterday that we were talking to Jennifer Utley about the new season of Who Do You Think You Are, and this weekend marks the end of the season. Melissa Etheridge will be off to Quebec learning about her French roots on her paternal side. There's a scandalous lawsuit back there, an adventurous ancestor in the American colonies. And by the way, if you're new to family history research, when you watch this show, remember this isn't truly a reality show. Family history finds do not happen the way they're shown on Hoodoo and similar programs. It is much easier than it once was, but it still takes a lot of effort and often many years to solve the mysteries of your past. But you know that, of course. Also, if you missed it, the AMC series Turn, based on the exploits of Washington's Culper spy ring, is on for its second season. It's a phenomenal program, particularly for depicting life in New York City and Long Island under British occupation during the Revolution. If you want a good idea of just the hardships of day-to-day living in the 1770s, yet alone the challenges of living through a seemingly unending war for independence, this is must-see TV. Of course, all of last year's episodes are available on demand, so if you haven't seen it before, you might want to catch up. The British are a little different here than they are in Downton Abbey. Julia Bell, whose maternal line is based in Plymouth, England, has been looking for her American World War II GI grandfather for 12 years. During World War II, Arthur Reivers was stationed in England and met a young British woman. Well, they fell in love and had a daughter named Helen, who later became Julia's mother. When Arthur was shipped home, the relationship was brought to an end. Julia first learned about this when she was about 10 years old and vowed to her grandmother that she would find Arthur. Well, she's now 45 and lives in Singapore. And Julia has worked databases, mailed letters, sent emails, you name it. She began the search in 2003 with a request to the Plymouth Herald to publish her grandmother's photo, which they did. Well, DNA tests helped narrow the hunt. And what's extra fascinating is that Arthur Reivers later became Arthur Garrett. Julia had no idea of that, or his age, or where in the U.S. he was from. She is now in touch with the family. And it just goes to show you, the question is, just how bad do you want it? We tend to think of genealogy as always being about the dead, but as this and the last few weeks have shown, it's often about the living as well. And that's your Family Histoire news for this week. Read about these and other stories on our website, extremegenes.com. And coming up next, we'll be talking to Megan Smolenyak, a genealogy adventurer who recently discovered a major error in the well-known lineage of Hillary Rodham Clinton. What did she find, and what kind of wake-up call does this error send to every researcher? Find out on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show.
And welcome back to Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show. It is Fisher here, your radio root sleuth, with my special guest. She's Megan Smolenyak. And Megan is, I love the way you title yourself here, Megan, a genealogical adventurer and storyteller.
Yes, yes, yes. That's exactly what I do.
And, you know, that really puts a much more fun spin on it than I think a lot of people think about this stuff as being. And you are exactly that. You go all over the place. I remember you discovered the Irish lineage of President Obama. How did you get involved in that?
I actually did that way back in 2007 when he was running for president the first time. And I was just curious about him. You know, he was sort of a new man on the scene. We didn't know much about him. And so I just started digging into his roots. And one of the things I was wondering about is, if you tuck his father aside, because he wasn't an immigrant in the traditional sense, in that he came here and then left, I wanted to see how far back you had to go to find an immigrant. And the most recent one I found was from Ireland. And so that got out there, and the next thing you know, I'm hearing from all these people in the Irish media going, well, that's great, but where in Ireland? And anybody who's done Irish genealogy knows that can be a challenge.
Yes.
We're talking a famine-era immigrant. And it took me about 4 months, but I finally found tombstones in southeastern Ohio that told me where to look in Ireland. It was a town called Monegal.
What a great experience for you. And did you ever hear from the president about that?
I got to meet him when they went to Ireland.
Really?
Yeah, yeah. I got the golden ticket to Monegal, and I actually wound up meeting he and the First Lady in Dublin. You never know where genealogy is going to take you.
No, believe me, in the last month or two, I can attest to that. Yes, and well, that's what makes you a genealogical adventurer. And the thing about it is we just never know where it's going to take us in our own lines or in service to somebody else.
That's true.
Recently, you were asked to do a little work on Hillary Clinton's lines because she's now back in the race for 2016. And I loved your column about this. Give us a little background on that.
So it was a magazine called Irish America that asked me to look into her roots because she was going to be inducted into the Irish America Hall of Fame. And I'll be real honest with you, when they first approached me, I was really concerned about it because you know how it's become sort of a sub-hobby to research famous people.
Right.
And so I thought, what am I possibly going to find that's new? You know, what can I say that hasn't been said before? But I just treat it like every other case. I'm old-fashioned. I start at the beginning, and I prove every parent-to-child link. You know, I'm just very methodical about it. And I was astonished to find that everybody, and I do mean everybody, had one of her grandmothers wrong, which, of course, means that the rest of the tree from that point on was wrong.
Wow.
It means that one quarter of her heritage was wrong.
Man.
Yeah, and you know, we see this all the time. We see mistakes in online family trees, but to find it, you know, in the family tree of somebody who is so well known, literally worldwide, and whom so many people have researched, that's kind of an eye opener. So I think the article you're alluding to, I wrote a piece saying, hey, this is a wake up call, because if a quarter of Hillary Clinton's family tree is wrong, what about your own?
What
parts of your family tree aren't quite accurate?
Well, now, she also got some criticism recently because she talked about all of her grandparents being immigrants. And I believe this particular one of those that was not, correct?
Right. She, for her, her immigrant generation was really her great-grandparents. And quite frankly, even that's a surprise to a lot of people because a lot of people just assume she has this sort of deep blue-blooded kind of heritage. For her, seven of her eight great-grandparents were immigrants. Only one of her four grandparents was. So I don't know if she misspoke, or I don't know if she, you know how sometimes people say grandparents instead of referring to grandparents, great-grandparents, and great-great-grandparents, or if she just got the family lore wrong. I don't know what happened, but yeah, that seemed to bring it. It's interesting, I had written about her roots and appeared several months ago, but all of a sudden there was a lot of interest in it last week because of that statement.
And then you found this information about Hannah, and then you came to a great conclusion, and I love it, about being a wake-up call for everybody who's into family history.
I mean, I checked. When I found out what was accurate, you know, I went to see, okay, who else got this right? because I assumed that some people got it right. And so I checked a whole bunch of different family history sites, and I could not find anybody who had it right. And as you would expect, somebody as well-known as she is, there were dozens and dozens of family trees for her on most of the sites, the popular websites and all. And I even checked some professional websites. Now, presumably some of them have been updated with the correct information, but nobody had it right. It was a case of two Hannah Jones born in the town of Scranton, Pennsylvania, around the same time, and nobody else bothered to check to make sure they had the right Hannah Jones. It's genealogy 101, and that's why it was so astonishing for me. I mean, I do so much research that I expect there to be mistakes in online family trees, but for me, it was a blessing because it gave me something fresh to write about.
Right. What was the feeling you had when you ran across that? I mean, it had to be swallowing the canary, right?
Yeah, like I said, it gave me some material for the article I've been requested to write. But as a longtime genealogist, I've been doing this since the sixth grade. You know that there's an unfortunate echo chamber effect online where there are a lot of folks with good intentions, but maybe not enough patience to do methodical research. And everybody just keeps on merging their trees in with everybody else's, and nobody bothers to check the links. And so it starts to look true just because so many people are claiming it. And unless you care enough to actually check every single link, you know, yourself, it's just going to keep on getting amplified. And so it's, over time, I'm concerned, because if you see it in the tree, like I said, if somebody's so well-known, imagine what's hiding in everybody else's trees. Imagine how much misinformation is floating out there.
You know, I think this is one of the advantages of joining certain lineage societies, such as the SAR, the DAR, the Mayflower Society, because maybe you don't want to be involved with the group itself, but to have them go through and check your lineage link by link, I mean, it's nice to have another set of eyes that are going to be out there making sure you haven't made mistakes.
Yeah, that sure would be nice if more people would do that, whether it's, you know, with assistance from lineage societies or on their own or even just with their favorite cousin.
That's right. And have you done that before, Megan? I sure have, where I wanted to turn it over to somebody else and say, look, I think I've got this right, but I'd like another set of eyes to go through this.
I do it sometimes, but a lot of times, for better or worse, the stuff that I do is, it's related to TV shows or there's the media connection. I don't always have the luxury of sharing what I've done.
Yes.
Traditionally, for example, I was chief family historian for Ancestry for several years, and I was their spokesperson, and I just believe in bulletproofing, you know, anything you go out with. I won't share a story unless I'm sure of it. And I've resisted pressure from PR people to share stories that I just didn't feel were fully hatched or fully substantiated. And that can take some doing to do, but I won't go out with anything unless I'm really, really confident of it. And, yeah, when I can, of course, I try to get somebody else's opinion on it.
Yeah, you have to think about the ordinary genealogist, the person who's spending, 2-3 hours a week at it, perhaps. How difficult that is to resist the temptation to copy somebody else's line because it looks so good.
I know. It's something that we all have to just be really aware of as we're researching our family trees because, I mean, if you don't care about accuracy, then what's the point, you know? Why not just make it all up? There's some good research out there, but you really need to explore the trees that you're looking at combining with. You need to look at their research, see the sources they cited, see if they put any original documents up there or if they're just citing 12 other trees, you know?
Right.
I use trees to give me theories. But I have never merged a tree, ever.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense. You know, you really think about that. Family Search, of course, is working very hard to try to clean up a lot of the old merges from decades and really a century of material that's come in from various people around the world. And now starting to demand that there be documentation for each link and each individual. And it would be nice to see something similar.
Not everybody feels that way. Not everybody is doing the same thing that Family Search is doing. And for, you know, let's say the recreational genealogist, somebody's just getting into it because they caught an episode of Who Do You Think You Are, how are they going to know that they should, that, you know, depending on what resources they're using, that maybe they should double check? There really is no way for them to know.
Well, that's exactly true. I mean, it's really the effort that must go into this to make sure that the lines are correct.
I tend to live tweet the episodes, some of the genealogy shows online, and almost every time there's you'll find other people on Twitter, no matter who the topic is, they'll go, hey, I'm 16th cousins three times removed with them. And you know that they're just going into one of these online services and taking what they see at face value when they can find it out in 5 minutes, you know. So unfortunately, that whole tendency is becoming more pronounced.
Yes, it's getting more pronounced because of the fact is, as everybody's promoting, it's getting easier and easier. I'm never one to say it's easy because it's not. But it is easier than it once was.
Well, that's the thing. I'm very much about inclusivity. I'm one of those people, the more the merrier. I want as many people excited about genealogy as possible. But I do think it is harder now for the new genealogist to just sort of master the basic skill set because being told just go online and click, 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 and poof, instant roots, you know. I just wish people were given a fuller context and had a better understanding of a little bit of elbow grease isn't a bad thing, and it's actually kind of fun to do the whole detective game.
It's well, it's like anything else. It's like when you're a kid and dad or mom lets you play with certain tools, and they're great, but they really need to show you exactly how the tools are intended to be used.
Yeah, and again, I don't want to sound nitpicky, but I just say this as somebody who's been online since the beginning and started in the old snail mail days, you know, paper and pencil days, and just slowly watching the trees become more and more, the word I would almost use is polluted over time because of that echo chamber effect I mentioned, which is just unfortunate. Hopefully it will gradually be, you know, rectified, as what you mentioned with Family Search.
Yeah, I'm always recommending to people, I think it's still very important that you keep your own database and not something online that can be shared or lost or whatever.
Yeah, that's always a good idea. Absolutely.
Megan, thank you so much for your time. You're heading out on a world tour here soon, so have a great time.
Thank you.
And coming up next, you know that whole thing about that line back to Adam and Eve that some aunt of yours gave you 30 years ago? We got to talk about that with Ancestry Pro genealogist Gordon Remington on Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show, and ExtremeGenes.com. You know, one of the things that happens when you move into the exciting world of family history research, you learn a couple of things real fast that don't necessarily work real well. That's the line back to Adam and Eve and coats of arms. And that's why I have my friend Gordon Remington in from ProGenealogists. Gordon, I've known you for 25 years or so, and this is one of the most interesting things to me is, where did all this stuff about a line back to Adam and Eve come from? I mean, we all descend from them, but the lines have a problem.
Well, yeah, Scott, it's basically a matter of, can you prove it on paper or by documentation? And way a long time ago, back in England in the 700s, 800s AD, the kings of England were all pagans. They were Anglo-Saxons that came over from Northern Europe to England, and because they had to prove their descent, or say they descended from a god, they all had a line that went back to the god Odin, who is the chief god of that Norse
I thought he was at center with the Portland Trailblazers, but it didn't work out so well.
Well, yeah, he's got a lot of descendants. Anyway, so the Anglo-Saxon kings, in order to be king, they had to have this descent from a god. When they became Christians, probably coming around that same time period, they couldn't do that anymore because they couldn't descend from a pagan god. So they called their court poets together, and all these Anglo-Saxon kings, there were seven of them, but they're all distantly related. They all claimed the same descent. They got the court poets together and the bards and so forth, and they said, we want to know how we descend from Adam. And I think these guys were under pain of death.
I mean, if the king asked me, because to go through there, I will find the line that you require, sir.
Because remarkably, they all came up with the same line. And so they added from the earliest king that they all agreed upon that was a real person, they added generations going back to Odin. Well, they already had done that. They already had gone back to Odin from that king. And then they added more generations from Odin back to get to Noah on the ark.
Okay, wait a minute. What's the story of Odin, by the way? What was his, you know, every god had a purpose. It's
the he was the chief god of the Norse god.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, in Norse mythology, you had Odin.
Yeah.
And he was the father of Thor and all these other gods that were up there. And he was like the head god. Okay. His official name.
He sat at the head of the table.
Basically, he was called Odin the Allfather. Father of everything, you know. So anyway, he was a pretty powerful guy.
And so they would link back from the earliest guy they agreed on.
Yeah.
And then try to figure out how this connected back to Noah.
Well, what they did was they invented generations between Odin and Noah, which included, in some accounts, a son that was born on the ark who wasn't in the Bible. So they conveniently got around the Bible thing of three sons of Noah.
Right.
by inventing a guy who was born on the ark. And because I guess it just wasn't written down, but these guys figured him out. I don't know how, but they all agreed on it.
Right.
They all lived.
Yeah, they all lived and they survived. Yeah.
And so this was written down in chronicles, and I don't even call them documents. It was just written down. Well, the reason why they wanted to know this descent is because when they came in to greet their subjects and their barons and everything, their ancestry would be sung out. Son of so-and-so, son of so-and-so.
In song for generations.
Yeah, yeah. And it would just it would establish their kingship. This was written down, and it was accepted as the descent of the Anglo-Saxon kings. And the Anglo-Saxon kings were, after the Normans invaded, William the Conqueror, who was from France, invaded, they married into that line. So the current kings and queens of England do descend from those early Anglo-Saxon kings way long back. But
so in the 800s then, at that point.
Yeah, oh yeah. And so basically, if you look at anybody whose ancestors goes into the royalty of England, it'll eventually go back to the Anglo-Saxons. And from the Anglo-Saxons, that's where you get this line to Adam. Now, it isn't that tough for Americans to have a descent from royalty.
Right. You know, because many New Englanders are, what do they call those, gateway ancestors?
Gateway ancestors. I've had a couple. I've got a couple of gateway ancestors.
As do I, yeah.
And I think the thing for people to remember is whether you descended from royalty or whether you can prove a descent from Adam, it doesn't make you any different of a person.
No.
and especially putting that descent from Adam down on paper doesn't make a lot of difference.
No. You know? No, it really doesn't.
Really.
Now, as I remember hearing once that they wanted to link into the Bible lines, but the Jewish fathers at the time of the Bible, when those lineages were in there, if they didn't like an ancestor, they were out. Is that correct?
Maybe so. Maybe so. Okay. I'm not a biblical scholar. So,
all right.
Yeah, I don't pretend to be that. But I do know my history. I majored in English history, and this is one of the things I studied were these Anglo-Saxon chronicles and so forth. And I learned very early on that the earlier you go, the more it's based on tradition and wishful thinking and staying alive.
Right. Wow. All right. So what about these charts now? I mean, those charts are everywhere. You see people with the line, you connect back to this person, and boom. And there are many different branches. Are there not by now?
Well, that's,
or is that mostly because of the royalty branch?
That's the royalty stuff. In most cases, the people that want to claim descent from Adam on paper, who hook into these royal lines, it's ready-made for them. It's going to be out on the internet. I'm sure that if you're genealogically savvy and you go to the internet, you can find all sorts of things that tell you this is not right. But there's some people that just see that and they say, oh, wow, I have a descent from Adam. And I say, well, so does everybody.
Right.
But the thing is a matter of documentation, because documentation doesn't exist. It's first of all, these oral histories that were written down eventually start out just as songs and traditions. And so you have no documents to back them up. It's just names that are repeated and repeated and repeated in long lines. And, you know, so there's going to be no paperwork back then that's going to prove what these guys said was the case.
What percentage of Americans do you think right now are descended from English royalty?
Oh, I have no idea. It
has to be a large percentage.
Well, you've got to calculate in there how many people have lines that go back to colonial New England, because that's the gateway.
Right.
Most of the royal descents in this country come out of colonial New England ancestors who came over.
Mm-hmm.
There were also some that came to the colonial South, but their documentation back to England isn't as good as the New Englanders. So
it's been a long-going tradition, though, for a lot of people to link in. The royalty is the big thing, which to me is kind of surprising, because the fact, if you really look at the history of the royals, it isn't really pretty.
No.
A lot of death.
Yeah.
A lot of really bad marriages.
Yep.
You know, ask Henry VIII. It ended badly for a lot of people. And yet we seem to like to tie into them, I suppose, because they're historic figures more than the fact they were really swell guys and gals.
Well, the only people at that time where there's any documentation.
How reliable are the royal lines beginning at what, obviously it must be right now to Queen Elizabeth, all the way back to a certain point, are pretty reliable to when, would you say?
I'm going to say probably to about maybe 700 or 800 A.D., because beyond that, in the Anglo-Saxon lines, is when you begin to have this tradition. The Anglo-Saxons came from Germany, what's now Germany in that area, to England about 400 to 500 A.D. And there are reliable chronicles that talk about who was there at that time that were kept by monks at the time, the only educated people around who were keeping records, reporting on these are the people who are in charge. But before that, a lot of it is just tradition.
And then this comes from these people you were talking about working to keep their jobs.
Right. Well,
by proving the lines.
That's right. That's right. proving in quotes.
Exactly. Yeah, yeah. So there you go. This is an education. I know there got to be people listening right now are going, oh, no, Aunt Bessie's just going to be devastated.
You know, you got to realize that it's not always the best thing in the world to start your genealogy. You find out things you don't want to know. But I say, thankfully, it's just this bogus stuff back 1,000 years ago and not something about your grandfather.
Yeah, that's true. Although there is always something about grandfather, too, isn't there?
Oh, yeah.
All right.
Yeah.
Great stuff. Now, this is just one part of the fake line business that is always out there waiting for new suckers, basically,
right,
to come
right,
along.
Right.
There are other areas, which are?
Well, heirs to estates.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
I descend from the Anarchy Jans.
Oh, well, you're
story,
one of those.
Is,
huh? Yes. Well, the most famous one. Yeah,
yeah, probably so.
Yeah.
And if you're not familiar with it, it was basically she had a piece of dirt in Manhattan Island by her first husband. And then he died. She married the second minister among the Dutch, a guy named Everardus Bogardus, and which is one of the great names ever given to anybody. He Latinized his name when he came over from Holland. And then when they passed, the land was distributed among her children. But one of the children was not represented in the transfer. And it was discovered about 75 years after her death. And one of the descendants said, hey, wait a minute. That land is now valuable because New York was turning into a thriving city. This old farmland, which was, you know, on a swamp, wasn't worth anything back in the day. So they started battling to gain control of that. And that battle went on, I've heard, as late as the 1950s. Lawyers were approaching people going, hey, it's worth billions now. We can make you a lot of money.
Yeah, and actually, though, that the New York, one of the courts in New York had actually already settled that by that time, saying that it was so long ago and the records were so bad. You know, there's no way we can figure it out.
Gordon, great stuff. Thanks for coming on.
Hey, thank you, Scott.
And coming up next, Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com with more common sense advice for preserving your family treasures. On Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show and ExtremeGenes.com. And welcome back to Extreme Genes, America's Family History Show at ExtremeGenes.com. Fisher here, your radio root sleuth with Tom Perry from TMCPlace.com. He is our preservation authority. And Tom, you are in a dither right now about some software that I know you've been recommending for years. And you're, what's the matter? Look, you're almost white. What's the deal with you?
This has really got me scared. I hope the rumors are not true. I had people send me some emails. I had somebody actually stop in one of our locations the other day and say they had heard that Cinematize went out of business in January. And I'm going, what? That can't be. So I've been doing some sleuthing around. I went to newegg.com, which is where I always tell people to go to buy the software. And basically this is what it says. I'm looking at their site right now. I typed in Cinematize. It says, we have found zero active items that match Cinematize. The results below are deactivated items related to the keyword, and then they have all the versions of Cinematize out there, which is actually made by a company called Mirizon that is spelled M-I-R-A-I-Z-O-N. So this really scared me. So then I went to their website, Cinematize's website, and their online store is closed. They still have a functioning phone number where you can leave voicemail because nobody answers. And I've left voicemail for them to call me back. And so I really hope these rumors aren't true. I hope somebody is buying them or they're doing a relicensing thing or something like that.
Something's happening there, though.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah, and it's really, really scary. So the thing that I'm hoping is they're just going through a thing right now where somebody new is going to buy them or somebody's going to re-release their software. You have to have this software. Is both for PC and Mac. The cool thing about it is we have people every day bring us in videotapes and reel-to-reel audio tapes and film and all kinds of stuff that they want to be able to edit at home. And so the most economical way to do it, which we've talked about in previous shows.
Many times.
Yeah, we want to transfer it to a DVD because it does two things. It preserves it and gets it in a digital format, plus it gives them the ability they can edit it later on. With this software called Cinematize, you can take any DVD, and now with their new version 3 HD program, you can actually take Blu-rays also and rip sections off of the DVD. You don't physically rip it off. It basically records it to your hard drive.
Now, wait a minute. When you say that it's a new software, how new are we talking?
Well, that's their latest incarnation. It's called Cinematize 3 Pro HD, and it's the first software I have ever seen that comes out that will actually let you rip out of a Blu-ray. But Cinematize came out with this new one late last year, and I hope it's still available someplace, and I hope somebody licenses it. Because the neat thing about this software is once we digitize it for you on a DVD, you can take the DVD at home. Say you have a two-hour VHS tape that you've transferred, and there's this little two-minute section that's really, really cute. Cinematize will allow you to rip off just that two- or five-minute segment. This is a program you have to have in your arsenal or your quiver.
All right. Tom, remain calm. Take a deep breath. You know, inhale. Yes, we get the picture here. Tom, have you recovered from your meltdown?
Somewhat.
Catch your breath. All right. We've got to talk about this because we got an email from Tennessee asking about sticky photo albums. You remember these? These were in the 70s. They are horrible because of what they've done to photographs.
Oh, exactly. They were horrendously bad. In fact, I tell people what you want to do if you have stuff in a sheet like that, or even the old ones that they had the black paper, they had those little licky corner things you put over your photo. The problem with a lot of that stuff is people try to remove it, and they end up damaging their picture, and they say, well, you know, the corners are covering part of the picture. Yeah, that's sad. But before you go ahead and try removing them, scan the stuff in the sheets. If you don't have a big enough scanner, there's a lot of places like our facility where we can scan them for you. Because once they're scanned, if something bad happens, at least you've got what you started with. Too many people try taking it apart. They destroy their pictures. They damage their picture. And it's almost impossible to go back to where they used to be. There's no undo feature when you're doing stuff physically, only on the computer. So what you want to do if you have the old albums like that, first you want to do is scan them. Then the next best thing, if you have the ones that have the little sticky corners, is get a knife very carefully and cut the corners away from the black. You're not cutting the corners away from the picture. You're cutting them away from the black background.
Yes, and that goes back to what, the 30s and 40s?
Oh, yeah. Even
and the 50s,
I mean,
yes.
My grandma had photo albums before I was ever born of those kind of things. So they're really, really old, the old nasty-tasting little corners. And so what you want to do is you want to cut the corners off of the paper so they're still on the picture, then some of them hopefully will just fall right off, and then you're fine. Some of them, if they licked them too much or they got some humidity, some of the glossy photo substrates could have actually adhered to the top part, and then that's going to be a problem. So then the next thing, if it's actually touching a part of the printed paper, I wouldn't even try to take them off. If it's on the corner where it's white, you can real carefully with an X-Acto knife try and cut them off as careful as you can. But then once again, if you're going to do that, go and scan them again, because you basically removed more bad stuff from it. So now scan it again so you have a second scan.
And, you know, that's an important point for anything you're going to work on, is that if you're taking a risk of possibly damaging something and making it worse than where it was at the beginning, scan it first. And it doesn't matter what it is. You will never regret it.
Exactly. You're in Photoshop. You create something. Oh, that's ugly. I don't like that. You hit undo. In physical world, you can't do that. There is no undo button. So you want to scan. And once you've done that, then go to the next step. For instance, if they're the wax kind, a lot of times the wax will have dried off, and just kind of shake the page and the pictures might just fall right off. Then you're fine. If they're stuck on and they won't come off and they're starting to decolorize it, same thing. Scan it without the clear sheet. Make sure you move the clear sheet. Scan the photo. Then the same thing, get an X-Acto knife or sometimes even a credit card, and just kind of slide it, pushing more on the backing of the substrate, not the photograph, because if you're going to dig in or damage it, if you damage the book, who cares? You want to preserve your picture.
That's right.
And then once you get that off, you can get some archival paper, and if it's still sticky, put it on that, because at least that's going to keep from getting any worse. Sometimes you can turn them over, and very, very carefully, with an X-Acto knife or something as simple as a credit card, get that wax off enough that it's not going to be sticky. The wax can become almost like liquid and work its way through the picture.
Oh, boy.
And that totally cannot be removed unless you Photoshop it.
All right. Great advice once again, Tom. That's why you are the preservation authority. We'll talk to you again next week.
Sounds great.
And thanks once again to Megan Smolenyak for joining us today, talking about her discovery of a major error in all the published lineages of Hillary Clinton. And what that means to all of us, whether you're a Democrat or a Republican. Also to Gordon Remington for his great insight into your lines that are supposedly documented back to Adam and Eve. Take care. See you again next week. And remember, as far as everyone knows, we're a nice, normal family.
This has been Extreme Genes on the Mormon Channel.
brought to you by The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. Share your family story by going to FamilySearch.org.